I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network. Elizabeth Rosenthal has written a to-be-read book by everyone who is concerned about healthcare, and that means all of us. She's a terrific reporter. We had her on, you'll recall, for each of her New York Times articles, Paying Till It Hurts. And now she has a book, and the book is An American Sickness, How Healthcare Became Big Business and How You Can Take It Back. She was a longtime reporter for the New York Times. She is now editor-in-chief of Kaiser Health News, and she went to Harvard Medical School, trained and worked as a physician at New York Presbyterian Hospital. She writes, in the past quarter century, American medical system has stopped focusing on health or even science. Instead, it attends more or less single-mindedly on its own profits. She says the current market for healthcare just doesn't deliver. It is deeply, perhaps fatally flawed. Why does the U.S. spend nearly 20% of its national budget on health care? Why don't you get itemized bills when you go to the hospital or you go to urgent care centers to figure out exactly what everything costs? Why is it that some things are a certain price in one part of the country and quadruple the price in another part of the country? To say nothing of how much we spend for certain procedures, whereas if you had them done in Europe or in other parts of the world, it would not cost nearly as much. The book is very thorough. And a very important part of the book is what consumers can do, what you can do to actually wrest control of your health care from the ledgers, she says, of the medical industrial complex. We have a new phrase this hour. We're going to be loaded with phone calls. We always are when Elizabeth is on the air. So let me give you the phone number. This is the number one concern of Americans right now. I know we'll have a lot of calls, and here's how you reach us, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email is talk@WPR.org. Facebook is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Twitter is @KDunnShow. And Elizabeth, hello.
Hi, how are you?
Oh, Elizabeth, what a good book you have written.
Oh, thank you. You were there while I was writing it.
I know. It's just so thorough. It is such an important book. And, you know, I must congratulate you because nobody's doing this kind of work. And heavens, we need it now. We need to know all of this.
Well, you know, we talked over the years while I was writing the Pain Till It Hurts series at the New York Times. And what I realized as a result of that series was kind of that I just scratched the surface of the dysfunction. And also, as you know, that series had a huge degree of social engagement. I had literally thousands of stories from patients of ways in which the medical system wasn't working for them. And, you know, what does a journalist do with that? You go out and start digging. And so the starting point for a lot of this book were those stories and trying to figure out how did things end up costing so much? And realizing, unlike in the newspaper series where I kind of picked off, you know, stitches in an ER or getting a colonoscopy, one part of the system,
right,
how is it that all of these parts came together to historically, and that's what the first half of the book is, looking at the last 25 years, how did all these parts get together to create a system that nobody, literally nobody seems to like anymore, that is, as you mentioned, you know, three times as expensive as elsewhere in the world without getting better results. No one would design this system. So how did we get to this crazy place? And I think the first part of the book, what I came to realize, it's kind of a classic case of, you know, the road to hell is paved in good intentions. Every step of the way, people were trying to innovate in a positive way. And once business gets into the mix, that positive innovation is turned for profit rather than for health.
Mm-hmm. Your father was a doctor.
Yeah.
How have things in the 60s, and you tell some stories about your father and your brother getting into some medicine that he shouldn't have, but it was an interesting
yeah.
story because your father was getting paid for your chocolates, a little bit of ouzo, a little bit of this and that, a whole different system. People were paying out of their pockets, and some couldn't afford to pay.
Right. Now, that system kind of had a natural endpoint as treatments became more effective and more costly because they were actually much more effective. But, you know, if you're in a doctor's office and someone is writing you a check, you know, you do, first of all, you have a modest office. My mom did the billing and we helped. But second of all, you have to charge reasonable rates. And then, and my dad was a pediatric oncologist, so he wasn't doing primary care. He was doing pretty sophisticated stuff for the time.
Mm-hmm.
But what happens is, first, you know, in a good way, because, you know, treatments are getting better and prices are going up, the insurance comes in, and that's a good thing. I want to stress that. But what happens initially, because of how insurance was structured initially, where your employer paid if you were lucky enough to have employer insurance, and you didn't pay premiums or deductibles, it was as if nobody was paying. So what happens when you feel like nobody is paying? The visit that maybe cost $25 now costs maybe $250. And, you know, but there's still this, I'm a good doctor, I want to care for my patients. And, you know, and P.S., one thing that I found fascinating is, as a little aside, is a friend of mine from medical school sent me the surgeon's pledge that he took in 1990, where I, you know, when I was training. And it said, I promise to deal with each patient as I would wish to be dealt with, and I will set my fees commensurate with the services rendered. What doctor would say that now? But that was very much the ethics of the time.
Mm-hmm.
But then what you saw around the year 2000 is pure business consultants coming in. And I saw that, the leading edge of that, when I was practicing. You would see people with clipboards going around going, how could we do this more efficiently? And in the start, that was a good thing because hospitals were really inefficient. But over time, the metric of business, which is efficiency, revenue generation, really pushes aside that those values of medicine, you know, caring, listening, spending time, to a point where in the early 2000s you have, and there's a chapter in the book about this, which I didn't even realize, you have consultants from Deloitte and McKinsey coming in and saying, you know what, we're not, what's the most efficient way to make more money? Because we understand that hospitals are cash strapped. It's not to do things differently. It's just to bill better. And by better, they mean, you know, why don't you bill for recovery room time? Why is that included in the cost of surgery? Why is the ER doctor included in the cost of an ER visit? Bill, 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 bill. And that's how you start seeing those, you know, what we all know, those $17 charges for Tylenol. Because what's a reasonable price for Tylenol, especially when it seems like nobody's actually paying it? And you get this crazy inflationary cycle that rolls out from the consultants to the hospitals, to the doctors, to the drug makers, and on and on and on. And now guess what happens at the end of this? We're in a position where we are paying these prices now. We are paying the premiums. We are paying deductibles. We are paying high copays. And now we're going, wow, how did the prices get that out of control? And I think that's what I tried to understand. And it's kind of a harrowing tale where there's no one bad guy, but everyone is feeding off those kind of business values that are so foreign and would be so foreign to where my dad was. I mean, one of the best compliments I got on the book was my cousin, who's a gastroenterologist, called me and said, you know, our dads would be so proud of what you've written here, because the values of that caring profession, of, you know, what Hippocrates said, you know, you should, the reward of medicine is doing good. That's gone. And sadly, that's gone. And I think it's led to some of the money searching because, hey, if you're a physician and you're no longer getting gratification from spending time with your patients, getting to know them, you know, you think, well, I might as well get rich. You know?
Right, and some of them are.
Yeah.
But another valuable part of the book, we'll go back to the cost of things in a moment, is what people can do. And I don't think most people realize you have valuable advice for people to get an itemized bill, to find out where all the costs are, to find out who's coming to your bedside in the morning at 7 o'clock and you have no idea who the doctor is, and they might be charging $800 for how are you doing, and then leaving the room. All of this advice, which is so important, I think, Elizabeth.
Well, that's what I wanted to do with the second half of the book, because I don't like writing hopeless books. I don't want to, you know, write like, wow, this is terrible.
Right,
and,
right.
You know, there's nothing you can do, because I think one of the things I realized in understanding the history and in troubleshooting my own bills, as well as the bills of most of the New York Times newsroom for 2 years, was there are things you can do, and we've been kind of, we and our employers have been kind of asleep at the wheel as these prices went up, because they've gone up and continue to go up because we haven't asked those simple questions.
Right.
that we feel like we can ask when we buy a car or a home or go to the supermarket. You know, who would buy food if, you know, you went into the supermarket and you picked out, or better still, somebody picked out a bunch of stuff for you, and then, you know, a month later you got a bill that said $10,000. You would never eat again. That wasn't itemized. So I think, you know, where you can start is by acting as a consumer where you can. And, of course, you know, in an emergency situation, you don't want to be, like, shopping around. But much of a medicine is not an emergency situation. So there are little things you can do, and I think you should do, and they will save you money. And more important than that, or maybe equally important, is they'll send a message to your physician and to the healthcare system that we're on to this and mm-hmm. we expect better. So just little examples that are simple that I do with my own physician now. If you need a blood test, your physician's computer is likely now programmed to order that test from the hospital where he or she practices. Hospitals are really expensive places to have basic blood tests, and blood tests are mechanized. It doesn't matter if you do it in you know, a hospital or a commercial lab. So I now say to my physician, okay, fine, if you need to order that blood test, but please send it to this commercial lab like Quest or LabCorp that I know is in my insurance network, and I know will charge $7 compared to literally $700.
Oh, my gosh.
So ask, and we're shy about that. You know, we feel like, oh, it's going to be a bother. I like my doctor. I don't want to hassle. You know, your doctor doesn't want you to be ripped off. So, you know, ask. Likewise, if you need an X-ray, I would ask your physician now, okay, there are, you know, a dozen X-ray facilities near here. Which one does a good job, but also charges less? Because we know, you know, the price of an X-ray can range from $100 to $2,000, same exact film. Now, the first time you ask that question, your physician probably won't know the answer, and, you know, these X-ray facilities are likely not going to tell you, patient, but they do have to answer to your physician. And so what I want my doctor to do is to refer me to the cheaper ones and to say to the guy who's charging $2,000 for a knee X-ray, I'm not going to send my patients to you because you're ripping them off. And I think, you know, sadly, in a way, it's a burden to put on patients, but we can help infuse this kind of cost rationalization into a system that's really not responsive to our needs, in part because we haven't made our needs known. You know, we sit in our living rooms and look at these bills and think, oh, my God, that's crazy.
Right.
And we don't take it to the next step, yeah, which is I'm going to act on this.
In 1986, you write, Congress with the AMA had a goal to scientifically determine what each physician's service was really worth. How did they determine that, and why isn't there such a meeting of AMA and whoever needs to be at the table determine what all services are really worth, and then we would have a standard for what services are, and there wouldn't be this huge variation?
Well, for physician services, there still is. The problem with what we've seen, classic, you know, road to hell is paved in good intentions. They wanted to rationalize physician payments. So they made this complicated formula that included the years of training that you needed, the amount of time it did to take to provide a service, and the kind of technical aspects of that, what kind of equipment you needed. But, of course, when you use that formula, you from the very start, you start kind of favoring procedural things, right? So our payment systems to physicians really favors physicians who do procedures. But then the thing that's really fascinating is those values need to be updated because like a cataract surgery that may have taken, you know, 40 minutes to do 30 years ago now maybe takes 12 minutes to do, right, because it's much. And so the payments get readjusted every few years. And what happens, and they're done at this fascinating kind of backroom institution that nobody knows about called the RUC, the Relative Value Update Committee. But that takes place where physicians from 30 different specialties get into a room and argue. They lobby, basically, about, we deserve more than this. You know, no, that operation really takes 18 minutes, not 15 minutes. And because there are far more specialists who do procedures on the Bruck Committee, they tend to win out. And so, You know, the sad thing is even how physicians are paid is a product of lobbying, not of a... And you know, the physicians who were in that room, I hate to say this, but they're thinking as about the business of their specialty. They're not really thinking about what's best for my patient. And the poor physicians who are just trying to spend the time with their patients that they think their patients deserve often get kind of nudged out by this very procedure-oriented and lobbying-oriented negotiation.
Let's talk just a little bit about Medicare. You cover this, and there have been so many people saying doctors are losing so much money because of low Medicare payments, so they're not taking Medicare patients.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, like everything, medicine is highly local, so that depends on where you look. What you'll hear from many primary care payers, primary care physicians who are in small practices, is that Medicare is now their best payer. Because they're not in good negotiating position. Again, all of these prices are not the result of what we think the service is worth, but the negotiating power. So if I'm a doctor in private practice with two colleagues in the Bronx, I don't have a prayer negotiating for good rates from, you know, Aetna or Cigna. I'm going to take what I can get. And in fact, Medicare, which tries to set a rational payment rate, is their best payer. Now, other physicians who may be in really strong bargaining position, like a huge physician group, may say, oh, Medicare doesn't pay me as much, because they've been able to negotiate much, much higher rates. But it's totally, totally irrational. And I think what I'm hearing from a number of doctors is the weight of those continued negotiations and the paperwork and the arguing and the pre-approvals is really getting to them. And also how much their patients are having to pay. One of my favorite stories in the book is about a surgeon named Hans Reichsteiner who practices in northern Wisconsin. And he had always felt great about being a general surgeon. And then one day a patient came into him and the patient said, oh, you know, doc, thanks so much. You took out my appendix. I feel much better. But, gee, did you know the hospital charged me like $40,000 and I can't pay it?
Mm.
And he said at that point he woke up and said, you know, I'd always felt good about taking care of my patients, and now I realize I was saving their lives and bankrupting their family.
Mm.
And now he has started to come around with his fellow surgeons in the area to let's just have Medicare for all. Mm-hmm. Now, he's not typical, but I think, you know, what he said to me is, it's not a great payer, but it's okay. I can cover my costs. And that has been, in fairness, the logic for Medicare cost setting has been, we'll pay you cost plus. And a lot of physicians are getting a lot more than cost plus at the moment. And if you say to them, do you want to just go to cost plus 10% when they're making 300%? Of course people are going to say Medicare doesn't pay me enough. So I think we have to take a hard look at what physician time is worth, and particularly what primary care time is worth, because we say we all want to spend more time with our doctors. We don't want it to be just about writing scripts and ordering tests, but we don't have any way to reimburse that face time at the moment, and we severely undervalue it. So we kind of, and people have been saying this for years, we have to align our payment system with what we say we care about in healthcare.
Mm-hmm. So considering the fact that prices are going up and up and up, it's a huge issue that we can't even figure out how to reform healthcare. We go for years and years having debates and meetings and figure out an Affordable Care Act. Now we have a new president and a new Congress who wants to change that significantly. Do you think that the only way, because you looked at all sectors of why everything is costing so much, for us to lower costs, which is of great concern to Americans, is to move toward, and do you think we eventually will move toward Medicare for all?
I, you know, as a journalist, I don't really want to be prescriptive. I want to say, and I think what I try and do is lay out the menu of options. If you look around the world, there are many ways countries have gotten to far more affordable care than we have. And I'm not saying we should get to 6%. You know, my ambitions at the moment are pretty low in the sense of I just want to see the ship turned around. Let's kind of start heading down from close to 20% to maybe 12. You know, that would be a huge accomplishment, $1 trillion more for other things. So I think, you know, could we go to a kind of Medicare for all or Medicare opt-in single-payer kind of system? Medicare is a single-payer system. Sure, we could. We could do that. I don't think that's going to happen quickly, of course. That would be extremely disruptive to the business of medicine. And you have to be cognizant that when we say it's 20% of our health, of our GDP, that means it's 20% of our economy. So if we're lowering how much we pay, there's going to be a lot of job shifting. I don't want to say job reduction because I think there are better ways we can use those excessive jobs if we chose to go that route. You know, all the coders and negotiators might not be as necessary, wouldn't be as necessary in a single-payer system. But we could go to that in a more gradual way where we could say, as Hillary Clinton did at the end of the campaign last year, we're just going to lower the Medicare age every few years. And, you know, in 20, 40 years, we would wake up and go, oh, you know, we have a single payer. How did that happen?
Elizabeth Rosenthal is our guest. We need to pause for a moment, Elizabeth. She's written a very important book, An American Sickness, How Healthcare Became Big Business and How You Can Take It Back. She, of course, was a reporter for The New York Times for a long time and covered health. She's also a physician. And she has joined us many times before when she was writing that great series for The New York Times. We talked to her after each one of those articles appear, Paying Until It Hurts. She's now with Kaiser, and she is here for the whole hour to talk about many of the elements of her book. We have to talk about drugs, and she tells some pretty dramatic stories in this book as well. We'll hear some of those. She is with Kaiser Health News now. She also worked in China for the New York Times for some time, and so she's had quite a life and continues to. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. We'll be back to her and to you in a moment here on the Ideas Network. All right, let's go to phone calls for Elizabeth. Phil in Mount Horeb is our first caller for you. Hello, Phil.
Hi. I just wanted to make a comment about the idea of viewing healthcare as a free market. And this seems to be kind of the impetus behind the current Republican proposals in Washington. And I just don't understand how the ordinary citizen is to be expected to know, like, all the options available for them. And, you know, if I'm having headaches and I go to my doctor and they say, well, maybe it's this or maybe it's that, I think you should get these tests. And now I'm supposed to go and research what I might need and where I could get it for cheaper and all of that. It just makes no sense to me how that would ever work. I just don't see healthcare as functioning the same way that the market for buying groceries does. And so for that reason, I think the idea of a single payer is really the only option in today's complex world of, you know, all the options available to us.
Yeah, I mean, the idea that a free market is applicable to healthcare, I think, is highly flawed. I think in the book I say, you know, the invisible hand in healthcare is on the till, which I think is true these days. You know, and I tried to say to one person who was shopping for pregnancy care, you know, she was trying to do the right thing because she wasn't covered for her pregnancy. And at the end of it, I said, well, Renee, it's like you're shopping at a restaurant with no prices on the menu. Mm. And she said wisely, yeah, but at this restaurant, they're always choosing what you get. And they're always choosing Moët Chandon when you'd be happy with tap water. And I think, you know, there we are, the fallacy of this works as a free market. Now, that doesn't mean there aren't things you can do to be wiser to how you're being charged that will save you money. And I mentioned a couple of them. And I do think we have to apply our consumer skills. You know, one person in the book got a bill for a 24-hour hospital stay for some minor GYN surgery that said $45,000 miscellaneous. And that was her tipping point, you know. Miscellaneous. Well, she didn't even mind the $45,000. It was the miscellaneous. So she went and said, what am I being charged for? And I think we need to ask those questions, because the more we ask, the more we'll get responsiveness from a system. And will it come in the way of a conversion to single payer, or will it come in the form of just much more accurate and transparent prices that we can work with, or some kind of price regulation? You know, we talked about how physician fees are at least rationalized in some way. It's gamed a lot, but there's an attempt to rationalize them. There's nothing at all like that with respect to tests, with respect to pharmaceutical costs, with respect to devices. By law, we prohibit that kind of negotiation at a national level. And I think, boy, you know, we see what's happened, the results, mm-hmm. you know. We're paying 2 to 3 times more than everyone else.
And trying to be influenced, you write about advertising in the book, how much the medical industrial complex puts into advertising. It's a huge amount, getting us to go to a certain hospital or use a certain kind of drug. Why do that? Why would you advertise that?
Well, because it pays. I mean, you know, I've spoken to advertisers about this. It pays. You know, because what's advertised? What's advertised on TV they're mostly extremely expensive drugs that you don't need to get a whole lot of people to buy into to make a profit. And P.S., studies show that if patients ask their doctor, that's the line, for a certain prescription, mm-hmm. and the physician thinks, I don't think it's going to help, but it probably won't hurt, they'll write the script. More than half of physicians will write the script because, you know what? You don't have time to explain why it's not really useful in your case. And anyway, every physician now is being rated on popularity scores, and they want to be liked, which is a dangerous thing when you're telling people bad news sometimes, mm-hmm. or no, sometimes. You don't need that scan. You don't need that test. So I think, you know, we are one of two countries that allow advertising, and part of what we can ask while that's legal. And the AMA in 2015, even the AMA, which is it's a big business too, but it recommended the end of direct-to-consumer advertising. But as long as it's there, we should be a lot smarter, and we should again use our votes and our voices to say we want truth in advertising. Then,
sure,
you know, these ads don't tell you this is for a very rare disease. The ads don't tell you, oh, actually, we're going to charge your insurer $37,000 a month for this ad. The ads, they're these soft focus, good stories about how someone who had a terminal disease is now at a birthday party, and then there are all those little side effects that whip by at the end.
I know.
Well, tell us which of those side effects are important. Tell us what the studies show about that drug, which is that, you know, in a small percentage of patients, it may extend life by 21 days. And, you know, you are very likely to have X, Y, and Z side effect. You know, approach those ads with the skepticism you approach much of life with. But because this is medicine, we kind of look through it with kind of rose-colored glasses. And I think, sadly, in a way, for now at least, we have to change our relationship with healthcare. And that includes... the favorite bee in my bonnet is, you know, look at hospitals in the U.S. They look like 7-star hotels, and we buy into that.
Yes,
you know,
right.
We go, wow, I love that hospital. There's free coffee in the lobby, and the art's
right.
great.
I know.
No, like, let's look at where the value is for our healthcare, not to the kind of bells and whistles that are really attractive. But you know, if someone said to you, we're going to charge $100,000 for your hip replacement rather than $40,000 because there's nice art on the walls, you would say, forget it. You know, I have art in my home.
Thanks, Phil, for your call. Let's go to Charlie in Milwaukee. Hi, Charlie.
Hi, thank you. And I am very appreciative and agree very much with the last comment of your guest regarding how hospitals are decorated. My comment is more related to the fact simply that we do already have a system for single payer within the United States, and that's the VA system. Mm-hmm. The VA system is filled with some of the hardest working, best, and very caring doctors, yet it's in a specific single payer system that some people in the United States would not want their health care to be. So I guess people who want to do a single payer should say, look at the VA system and how could we do a different way of doing the VA if you want to do it that way, or just adopt the VA for all and you'd have a single payer. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Charlie.
The VA has gotten, in my mind, an unfairly bad rap in recent years because of some of the things it didn't do and needed to do better. But it does a lot of things really well that our healthcare system doesn't do. And I agree, people will say to me, oh, well, the quality of the doctors are not good. Some of the hardest working, best physicians I know have been drawn to the VA system specifically because they don't have to deal with all these kind of marketing and finance pressures that doctors feel so kind of heavily and egregiously in a lot of the more commercial sectors of medicine. You know, I hear from so many doctors who are just fed up by the fact that their salaries are now tied to their productivity. Again, a business metric, maybe not a good, healthcare metric. We're not talking about, did you spend time talking to your patients? Is their blood pressure good? Are they exercising and losing weight? We're talking about productivity. You know, how many patients did you see? How many test orders did you do? That's not a medical value. That's a business value. But that value drives a lot of our medical system these days. Mm-hmm. And a lot of your doctors, even at the most august medical centers, are being paid with productivity bonuses. I think that's really sad.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit about drugs. This is a somewhat complicated story, but I think it's important, Elizabeth, you tell it in the book, because of who all is involved in making money off this, and it's a good explanation of why drug prices are going up. You write about this 53-year-old chemistry teacher at New York Stuyvesant High School, a PhD in chemistry. He has suffered from arthritis, a serious form of arthritis, and all of a sudden there are new drugs that hit the market. Jeffrey Keevy, is that his name, Keevy?
Yep.
To tell his story, this is an amazing story.
Yeah, and he is an amazing person to come to me with this story. I'm very grateful to him to not just accept it because his insurance would have paid. So basically, Dr. Keevy has something called psoriatic arthritis. The drugs to treat psoriatic arthritis have improved dramatically in his lifetime. They're infused generally once a month, once every 6 weeks. And you see a lot of them advertised on TV. So anyway, he was doing fine on a drug called Remicade for years and years and years. And then his doctor, his rheumatologist, moved to a new hospital in New York. He had gotten that Remicade infusion for $19,000 at a hospital downtown. She moved 20 blocks north to another hospital, and suddenly that exact same infusion was being billed at $120,000. And Dr. Keevy, he's a teacher in New York City schools. He wasn't paying, but he looked at these bills, as I think we all should, and said, whoa, this is just wrong. Now, he kind of tongue-in-cheek said to me, well, I went to the new hospital, and here I'm being charitable in not naming names, and said, well, I thought it might be a bit more expensive because I had my own little room, and there was free Wi-Fi, and there were cookies
right.
and bottled water.
Yes.
But he didn't imagine that it would be $120,000 instead of $19,000.
Wow.
So he started to, and he got all sorts of non-explanations. And, of course, the answer is just the prices will rise to whatever the market will bear. And the second hospital tried to bill a lot, and his insurer paid. And he tried to stop his insurer from paying. And they said, oh, look, what do we have to do? Look, we negotiate a little bit. I think they paid $80,000. He was furious. He contacted me. I went down the same rabbit hole of trying to get an explanation. And there is none other than the answer you so often get when you're a reporter in this field is, well, it's legal.
Mm.
And you're like, right, it's legal, but it's bankrupting families. It's making everyone who
yes.
supports New York State teachers insurance with our tax dollars pay more. And there's a lot of stuff we're not doing because we're spending, you know, an unnecessary $1 trillion on healthcare.
And then there's another part of the story that NYU, I believe you write, holds the patent on the drug, so they get a profit from it every time it's used.
Yeah, you're naming names now. Yes, it's true.
But you did that, so that's okay. I'm sorry.
No, that's fine. The second hospital was NYU, and the physician who held the patent on that particular drug was at NYU, is at NYU, and he had signed over some of the rights to NYU. So, yes, in a really perverse twist on this story, they probably made money by charging more for this drug. So, and the sad aftermath of this, you know, that isn't in the book is, on principle, Dr. Kibbe said, I'm not going to take this drug anymore. I'm not going to have my insurance ripped off that way, and switched to a drug that he could take, give himself at home. It was a lesser injection, or it wasn't a lesser, it was a subcutaneous injection. It didn't work as well for him. He suffered from it. And when he tried to get back on this drug that had worked for him, his insurer denied it. So, you know, the guy who's trying to do everything right, trying to be cost conscious in a system that is so business focused, you're really up against a lot. And even as you are with Dr. Kibbe, who has a PhD in chemistry, understands all the medicine of his disease, it's really, really tough.
Elizabeth Rosenthal, our guest this hour, her book, An American Sickness, How Healthcare Became Big Business and How You Can Take It Back. Our number is 800-486-8655. We'll return to your phone calls in a moment on the Ideas Network. Let's go back to phone calls for Elizabeth. Wayne in Marshfield. Hi.
Good afternoon. You know, I think we as citizens need to take a second look at our Congress people. I think too many of them have been born and raised with a silver spoon in their mouth. Our family have gone through times when we had to decide, can we save a little less on groceries so that we can pay this bill? In particular, way back when that first health care bill was pulled off the docket in the House, when the Congressional Budget Office came in with their predictions, how much it would save in 10 years, et cetera, Paul Ryan was just giddy with the savings part of it. And this is unreal. It's on the backs of millions of poor and elderly and sick people that one can say this. And I think, as somebody earlier in the program suggested, we need a single-payer system that is not competing with the pocketbook and creating all this havoc.
Thank you, Wayne, for your call. Elizabeth?
Yeah, you know, I think Americans should become healthcare voters. You know, we here at Kaiser Health News were looking during the election last year to download little clips of the debates on healthcare, and there really weren't any. And it wasn't a voting issue for people, but I think what we're seeing at the town halls and what we should think about looking forward is this is a core pocketbook issue for people. And the answer, because patients, citizens have not been very vocal about this, has always been, you want to save money, pass on those costs, to, you know, prices rising, you want to save money, pass it on to the patients. You know, is it in the terms of higher premiums, higher co-payments, higher deductibles, cutting back on Medicaid, as we're hearing now? Those costs don't go away. They're just shifted on to individuals like you and me. And what I hear now from so many people, which is really wrenching, is, you know, families spending 20-30% of their disposable income on health care. And we're not even talking major illness. Major illness is catastrophic for your pocketbook, not to mention your health. We're talking, you know, paying your insurance, paying your deductibles, maybe a hernia surgery. And that's 20-30% of a lot of people's income. They're not sending their kids to college. They're not able to afford a summer driving vacation. You know, the strains are enormous. And, you know, we like to say, oh, we're going to make people more cost conscious by asking them to pay those higher deductibles. what I think we're seeing now is those prices are so high and incomes are stagnant enough that asking people to pay those prices is not like, we like to say, they should have skin in the game. It's like having a kidney. Like, people avoid interactions with the medical system. Even people who are relatively well off, because they're afraid of how much it's going to cost them. There's a wonderful piece by a healthcare physician at Harvard named Sarah Bja, who had, who talks about the effect of having a high deductible plan. I'm sorry, that's the wrong doctor I was referring to. But who talks about having an arrhythmia and avoiding going to the hospital, even though his heart was pumping fast and furious, because he had put his family on a $5,000 deductible plan to see how it affected them. And what he learned was, you just avoid care. And I hear that over and over again, and it's tragic.
It is. And some, it's not, it was an interesting part of your book, but some people are leaving the country because of their health problems, and they know they can afford it elsewhere.
Yeah, I mean, this was really a sad thing. I call them healthcare refugees. People who look at this system very rationally and say, I'm worried about staying here. So, for example, there's one woman in the book who's a type 1 diabetic who's finishing a PhD at Washington University in St. Louis. She's only looking for jobs overseas because in the healthcare system of the U.S., even with good insurance, her out-of-pocket costs are going to be $5,000 to $10,000 a year. Insulin prices have skyrocketed in the U.S., not in other countries, because of a patent dispute here. And she very rationally says, I'm too scared to stay in this country. Another person had her baby in Turkey, and I said, well, why did you choose that? She's an American. She decided not to come home to be with her family, which she very much wanted to do. And she said, 20,000 reasons. And that was the amount it would have cost minimum to have a normal vaginal delivery in the U.S.
Goodness.
Terrible.
Yeah, terrible. Let's go to Rick next in Madison. Hi, Rick.
Hello. I'm really enjoying your discussion, and it's but at the same time, I'm really bothered by it. I think we're all impacted by the awful price of health care in America. But one thing that comes to mind, and that's that the majority of Americans in the past, even in the present, would love to see more gun control, and yet the spineless people in Washington won't pass any more gun control. So I think that we're dealing with a monumental task here, trying to change the nature of health care. And you sort of answered it with your last answer that we all have to come together and fight for it, but it's going to be tremendously difficult with all the money that's being poured into it from the side of the people that are making money.
Yeah, what's the breaking point, Elizabeth?
Well, I think we're really at the breaking point. You know, it's in some way different than, I like the gun control analogy, but it's in some way very different because gun control for most of us is abstract, but all of us experience healthcare, and all of us know someone who suffered greatly from the prices of healthcare today. So I think we do have a different kind of motivation to attack this problem. I will say, you know, yes, everyone looks to Washington. A lot of the interesting innovation, in my guess, would be at the state level. So I encourage everyone, little thing you can do that will have a big impact is know who your state insurance commissioner is. In many states, those are elected officials. In others, they're appointed. At the moment, they're almost all people from the insurance industry, which means look at our physician provider directories. Horribly inaccurate. Horribly inaccurate. Unnecessarily so. A good insurance commissioner could say, those have to be accurate up to the week. So you don't get this, you know, this nonsense, which I really react to of, you know, in network but not seeing patients. You know, what on earth
yes.
does that mean?
Right.
For me, that means not in network.
Mm-hmm.
So I think a good insurance commissioner, we should look at that down ballot position and vote for a consumer protection person to be the insurance commissioner. Pressure our governor to appoint someone who's a consumer protection person. The insurance commissioner in California is a guy named Dave Jones, very unusual. He's a Harvard-trained human rights lawyer, I believe. And so he has really pushed hard to get insurers to behave better. So little thing you can do at a state level. I want everyone to look at their congressman and senator and say, how have they voted on the issues that matter to me? I think you'll be really surprised, because being influenced by pharma donations is a bipartisan phenomenon. Some of the most liberal senators and congressmen in the Senate and Congress vote very badly on health care. Look at things like, how did they vote on drug price control bills, allowing Medicare to negotiate? How did they vote on repealing the 2.3% excise tax on medical devices, highly, highly profitable devices like the hips and knees? That tax was supposed to support the Affordable Care Act. People like a certain senator from Minnesota who's really liberal voted to repeal that tax, sadly, because I think of influence from the industry in his state. So I think, you know, as voters, and I hope this book highlights where we should be looking, I would love to see, and I'm hoping to start a movement called WeThePatients.us. Mm. Now it's online. It's in a very primitive form. So people can join now, but I hope that we can all create a real patient voice that will look at how our local and state representatives and national representatives are voting and say, I'm a healthcare voter. You shouldn't vote that way.
Mm-hmm.
If I have time, a little tiny example.
Sure.
Look at your state legislatures. There have been really good bills in states like Ohio and Illinois to require of physicians, transparency. Let us know your prices was the one in Ohio, I believe. The one in Illinois said would require physicians to tell you if they're not in your insurance network. That seems like a no-brainer, right? Good for patients.
Right.
Those bills were both killed after pretty intensive lobbying by state medical societies. You should be the counter-lobby and say to your state representatives, no, I want that bill. You know, there's a single-payer bill going through the New York State just passed the state assembly, and it's going to the state senate. All of us as voters should say, how did you vote on that? If you want single payer, then vote for someone who says, I am going to vote for single payer and not deal with the pushback I'm getting from industry, who doesn't like single payer.
Mm. Let's just get at least a comment from Kay. We're almost out of time, but Kay, you've been waiting. Hi.
Hey. My comment was, when you go in for preventative care and you get the panel, the blood panel, and you get your results, say for glucose and liver function,
right.
And I have found that because of Obamacare and my rates going up, usually the doctor doesn't want to keep me on as a patient because I'm just doing preventative care. And then you go to another one, and the panel, what one doctor says is normal, the next may not. And I've done some research as far as like going with the Mayo Clinic and seeing what they have is normal. Why is that not standardized? Because a lot of the things...
Right. Can you do this in about 20 seconds, Elizabeth?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, the thing is that everyone's trying to make money, right? So one doctor will say, oh, you're coming in for a normal exam. Well, I'm going to make extra money by ordering a whole bunch of blood tests that are not covered. You know, it is tragic that Obamacare over time became kind of, for many doctors, second-class insurance because... I don't know why, because, it was a political question. Maybe it didn't pay quite as well, but I think, you know, we need a system that treats everyone with respect and with decent medical care and doesn't try and extract a little extra money for them, or often a lot of extra money mm-hmm. when they're not looking, which is mm-hmm. what happens now.
Thanks very much, Kay. Thank you, Elizabeth, for writing the book. So helpful. Such an important book. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for having me again.
Oh, our pleasure. Elizabeth Rosenthal, been a while since we spoke with her because she's been writing a book, and an important one it is. It is titled An American Sickness, How Healthcare Became Big Business and How You Can Take It Back. Thanks very much to Gretchen Brown for producing this hour. Thanks to Lisa Nalbandian for on-air production here in our Milwaukee studios. And thanks for all of your calls. I'm sorry we couldn't get to them. Please put comments on Facebook. We can get Elizabeth maybe to respond if she's doing a sequel to this. And that is The Kathleen Dunn Show.